Hey there, I'm Tal Zlotnitsky from Ignite IT Consulting. You know me from the Braving Business podcast, but when I'm not behind the mic, I'm helping tech startups and established companies ignite their full potential. I also help entrepreneurs and businesses in distress reset for success. With over three decades of entrepreneurial success, I bring hands-on experience to drive growth, navigate turnarounds, raise capital, and lead through innovation. Whether it's executive coaching or strategic transformation, I'm here to turn your business challenges into success stories. Visit igniteitconsulting.com and let's spark that change together. That's igniteitconsulting.com. Your journey to business brilliance starts now.
This episode of the Braving Business Podcast is sponsored by, well, me. I'm PJ Benoit, and I've been in the domestic and international logistics space for over 30 years. If you need any assistance with transportation or logistics, my team and I will jump at the chance to help. Whether it be parcel shipments, e-commerce, pallets and freight, full truckload, international air and ocean, imports, exports, warehousing and distribution, or really anything under the logistics umbrella, we got you covered. For more details, please go to shipwithpj.com. That's shipwithpj.com. Reach out to me there. Mention you found me on this podcast for a special surprise. And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business Podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Why, hello there.
Hey there, sir. How goes it?
I'm dandy. I'm dandy. How are
dandy.
You?
I am dandy. I like dandy. Dandy's good.
Dandy's good. Dandy's always good. It's good. It's a good word. Yeah. I'm trying to bring it back.
It is. It's a rare word. You know, it's like swell. It's a word you don't often hear.
Jolly good.
In fact, you know what? I'm going to make an effort on this entire episode to raise from time to time a few more words that we haven't heard in a while.
I mean, like
dandy's a good word.
Yeah, workers.
Dandy's a good word. Right, Steve likes dandy. Yeah. Right,
dandy's good. I've used that one a dandy long time.
Yeah,
trying to use it in the sense now. Yeah,
that's wicked great. Yeah, I'm definitely going to be throwing in some random words we haven't heard in a long time.
All right. Let's all try to collectively confuse our audience. That'll be perfect.
I know audience love being confused. It's, you know, it always works. I mean, I don't know why it wouldn't. Right.
So what are you guys going to be doing? I think it's either tonight or tomorrow night.
What do you mean? I'm living my life. Is there something we should be doing?
Yes. You should be outside looking up. It's going to be the largest meteor shower in some time. The Geminid meteor shower. It's supposed to be awesome. So if you have,
I got my telescope ready, BJ.
Do you have a telescope? Oh,
I'm ready. I'm jealous. Got an eighth grade. Still using it.
Oh, holy cow.
That's awesome.
that is fantastic. I did not know that. I'm trying to think of an old-fashioned word. I can't think of one that would render, you know, the degree to which I don't particularly care about this, but I'm glad that some people do. Ooh. And you're one of them.
By gosh.
Can you actually see it? Can you actually see what do you see?
Have you never seen meteors in the sky?
Are you judging me?
Just look up. I think you're working too hard. I think you need to every once in a while go outside, take a nice walk with lovely Aaron, and look up, and you'll see like this shooting star. And oh, it's beautiful. It's wonderful.
So the dinosaurs did. Look what happened to them.
That's right. Exactly. Are you trying to get me extinct, PJ? Is this what it's about? Are you trying to get me a rock in the face?
No. Gosh, I could do that on my own.
Speaking of rock in the face, yesterday at the end of a soccer match, the owner of one of the clubs rushed the pitch and clocked the referee in the face. I mean, I'm talking clocked him. And he's now in prison. This team owner was arrested. And the referee who fractured, a bone in his face has said he will not referee ever again, which is shocking. But anyway, that's what happens when when you're not expecting it. People pound you in the face with a stone or a fist.
Wow.
I don't think it's a good.
That's why I stopped playing Turkish soccer a few years ago.
Is that right?
Funny you brought that up.
Yeah. And I also, just a personal credo of mine, stay out of Turkish prisons. That's what I tried to do.
It's a good idea, too. Yeah.
Did anybody see the movie? What was it called?
Midnight Express?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
I was far too young when I saw that movie. And and it left a mark on me. So yeah, I would agree. Yeah. Stay out of Turkish prisons.
Yeah, that.
But try to enjoy Turkish delights, which are quite tasty.
Coffee is good.
Oh, Turkish coffee is wonderful. And the food's good. The food's wonderful.
Yes. Food's not bad. As a matter of fact, it's a nice Turkish restaurant not far from my house. All right. On that note, we have gone far afield and have yet to introduce our esteemed guest, PJ. I think it's time we do that and get the show on the road.
I thought he was going to introduce us because Steve is famous. It's Steve Seibold, right. Everybody. Steve Seibold. He is a former professional athlete and national coach turned author and speaker on mental toughness training for sales teams. Wow, say that six times really fast. Steve has co-founded four companies that have achieved great success with offices in 10 countries around the world. In 1986, the year that I graduated from high school, Steve founded Mental Toughness University, which has helped corporations increase sales collectively by more than $1.3 billion with a B dollars. The author of 12 books with 1.8 million copies in print worldwide include the international bestsellers 177 Mental Toughness Secrets of the World Class, How Rich People Think, and Secrets Self-Made Millionaires Teach Their Kids, books for which Steve has interviewed over 1,000 of the world's wealthiest people. Steve is ranked.
I don't even know 1,000 people altogether, wealthy or not. So that's quite amazing.
Dude, I'm connected to like almost 20,000 people on LinkedIn, and I know like four of them. Steve is ranked among the top 1% of professional speakers worldwide and is the current president of the International Personal Development Association, an organization with 16,000 members around the world dedicated to reducing human suffering through personal growth. You've seen Steve on television, including on The Today Show, Good Morning America, ABC News, Fox, CBS, BBC, and NBC Australia. Steve, it is an honor and a pleasure.
Was that your best Australian accent?
That was pretty lame. Weird. It's not my best, but it was. Okay. I will agree, lame. Steve, it's an honor and a pleasure to welcome you to our humble little abode, this corner of the world, the Braving Business Podcast.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on. Impressive introduction. I sound very important, although I'm really not, but no, sounds good. Sounds good on paper.
All right. Well, if you're not that important, we probably shouldn't have you on.
I said, I'm out of here.
It's been fun, guys.
You know, listen.
It's been great, guys.
You've sold a few books. I mean, selling 1.8 million copies of a book or multiple books worldwide is a hell of an accomplishment. So for your humility aside, it's really quite an honor to have you here. And we'd love to dive in. You've had an interesting journey. You were a professional athlete. I'd love to hear a little about that. I actually played semi-pro baseball. PJ played Little League. And so, you know, we're almost all on the same level.
Hold on. Don't oversell it. Yeah. I played T-ball. So please continue.
T-ball. Nice. Okay. Very good. I could have sworn in our interview with Xavier Scruggs from Baseball Tonight, I think you said Little League. But okay. You know what? We'll have to rewind the tape.
I might have lied. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Anyway, you transitioned from being an athlete to being an author, a speaker, and mental toughness is kind of your forte. That's kind of where you've made your mark. And obviously you've also done quite a bit of very interesting stuff around what makes people successful, which we definitely want to get into. But tell us first about what initiated your spark that drew you to entrepreneurialism and looking at mental toughness in particular as a component of that. What was it that drew you to those things?
Yeah, well, I started playing tennis when I was 6 years old and kind of picked it up fast and started training in the next couple of years to be a professional tennis player. And I was lucky. I was right place, right time in Chicago, which Chicago was one of the powerhouses in the world at that point during the early 70s and for tennis. And so get on the path to being a professional player. And, tennis is an interesting sport because it's something where you can't get coached during a match. So you learn to internalize everything. You learn to sort of become the only way you can survive the junior tour or the pro tour, even playing college, is to go inside yourself. You have to be mentally tough enough to live with your decision-making because you can't get coaching during matches. And you learn to live with the losses and the struggles and the failures and the choking and all the things that go with sports, but you don't have a team behind you. Typically, you know, it's an individual sport. So it kind of led me to, in some strange way, being the life of an entrepreneur, I suppose, because it, in a lot of ways, as you guys know, it's the same thing as an entrepreneur. You know, there might be a team around you, but at 3 a.m, it's you making the decisions, thinking, am I doing the right thing for my team? Can I pull this off? Do I have the money? Do I have the time? Do I have the background, the edge, you know, all those things, all those doubts that we go through as entrepreneurs. And so I think it kind of prepared me a little bit, at least for, you know, becoming an entrepreneur.
That's it's really interesting. And I don't know that I've ever quite made the connection, and I think it makes a lot of sense, the connection you drew between a sport where you're an individual performer, like tennis, where you're on the field, that at some point, whatever coaching you've received, you're on your own. I mean, there's no more coaching. I would think another sport that's on some levels like that, maybe in some respects even more similar to entrepreneurialism is boxing, because you're actually taking some punches in the face, which proverbially you take a business too. But so in your estimation, it was the fact that you had the experience as a tennis player with the specific aspects of that being alone and needing to deal with the consequences of your decisions, mistakes, and successes, you believe that provided you with essentially a stepping stone into business that you perhaps otherwise wouldn't have had.
Yeah. I mean, think about it, Tal. It's just like, imagine PJ playing T-ball. Think of the focus it took him to focus on that ball sitting on the tee before he smacked it out of the park. I mean, it's the same kind of mental toughness that we're talking about here at that level. Now, I wasn't quite at PJ's level with T-ball, but I wasn't a very good T-ball player. But
PJ has actually shared that he in the same game, I believe, if I recall correctly, both hit a home run, which is not impressive because it probably meant multiple errors, balls through being thrown around, but also struck out in T-ball.
Yeah. Try doing that.
Yeah, it takes talent.
That is impressive.
Thank you. I think it does, because it, you know, I think sports, especially the individual sports, it does prepare you. And the mental toughness part for me came from the times I was really mentally tough. I did really well. I could hang in there and I was focused and all the things that kind of surround, you know, mental toughness in sports. And there are other times where I wasn't mentally tough and I would lose to some player from South Africa or something that I, you know, if you're a top player, typically, you know, all the people in the world in your division who can beat you. Typically, that's kind of where you're at if you're a top player. And I would lose to these people that, you know, I shouldn't lose to, because I would let down mentally. So I was back and forth. Some days I was mentally tough, sometimes not. And I became fascinated with this psychology, because I couldn't determine why I was mentally tough some days and other days I wasn't. And I became fascinated with it, and I've been studying it ever since, which is, you know, going on 50 plus years now, which is kind of crazy. But yeah, I think it did prepare me in a lot of ways. It really gave me the gift. I didn't get to where I wanted to be as a professional athlete. I only made it to the top 500 players in the world on my best day. But it's hard to make a living at that level. It was back then anyway. But it did prepare me, I think, to become an entrepreneur and to have some measure of success, you know, in the future.
Wow. Well, you know, I could have guessed that you're from Chicago because, you know, you're very intelligent and you're good looking. So that makes sense.
I already said you're a great T-ball
player.
Well,
you know, and I happen to live here anyway. So that's always good. Chicago is awesome. Chicago also, I think, just from an environmental standpoint, provides a good basis for everyone to have a good bit of mental toughness, right? Like, I just, when I'm thinking about other places.
Is that because of all the crime? Well, what are you referring to?
It's just, there is... Chicago is a unique market in that everyone...
That was tongue-in-cheek. For those of you that couldn't see my face because you're choosing to listen to us instead of watch us, I was joking and smiling about that. I am not making fun of the rampant violence in Chicago. Oh, how could anyone make fun of that?
It's reported rampant violence, right? Like, for those who live here, we know we're just an incredible city. And it's an incredible place to be, and everyone is awesome. They're just awesome. That's all I can say. But I think that there's a certain mental toughness because, you know, people kind of, you know, shoot down on Chicago a lot in regards to violence, even though all that's It's not pervasive throughout the entire city. We do have islands, of course, but it's not everywhere.
You're not alone in that. But you also have terrible sports teams.
That also provides some mental toughness. How do you keep cheering for the losers, right? So that also provides a little bit of foundation for that. So anyway, off of Chicago, I can go on forever. Steve, our wonderful guest in particular, you've had the unique opportunity to interview, 1,300 of the world's wealthiest individuals. Do you still keep in touch with them so that I can ask to borrow some money? B, how have these conversations shaped your perspective on wealth and success and the mindset that you've seen collectively through these individuals to achieve both?
Oh yeah, well, you know, just bringing it back to Chicago for a second, you know, I grew up in Elk Grove, which is just a middle class, you know, northwest suburb of Chicago. But so that's not a rich town. But you know, you travel. I played tennis in River Forest and Winnetka and Wilmette, and you know, some of those rich towns. And you think, man, why do these kids have tennis courts in their backyard? And you know, I'm picking weeds for 25 cents an hour at the church. You know, what's going on here? At least people get all this money. And I think, you know, traveling and tennis, coming from a middle-class socioeconomic middle-class family, you know, I saw all that and I thought, but tennis kids, some of those tennis kids are very rich kids. They come from rich families. A lot of them do, frankly. And they came from towns like that you and I know so well. And I became fascinated with it. So when I was in college, my first year of college or my second year of college, sophomore, 1984, I started interviewing. I interviewed a self-made millionaire. And I said, what is it about you people that have all the money? And then we're the worker bees and you guys don't seem to do much, but you have all the money. And I became kind of fascinated with that just as a side thing. And a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago now, the Wall Street Journal said it was the largest study ever done on the self-made rich. I don't know if that's true or not, but they said it. So wow. I guess it's true. But these are one-on-one interviews. These are not phone interviews. This is one-on-one. And I became fascinated with them, and I learned a ton of lessons from those people about the difference between the working class mindset that, as you mentioned, PJ, we do grow up with that. I think that's a generalization, but Chicago, they call it the city that works, and I think they're the people that work. It's a very down-to-earth place. There's not too much cockiness. I'm generalizing, of course, but you learn to go to work when you grow up in Chicago. That's what people do there. They go to work, you know, and it's a different mindset than the super rich, you know, seem to have. And so that's what I wanted to learn, and I did learn a lot from them. And I do keep in touch with most of them, the ones that are alive. Still, I keep in touch with, yes, a fair amount. Yeah.
I kind of love this. Tal, and I'm going back to a comment we've had on another podcast in regards to not being afraid to talk to people, right? And everyone is a person, and it doesn't matter if they're, you know, high up on a corporate ladder or they're cleaning out the bathrooms. Everyone's the same. We all have heartbeats and you know, similar bone structures, whatever. We're all human. And I find it fascinating that you're able to go and just kind of call through this morass of wealthy millionaires to have these conversations with them. What was that like to like reach out to someone who's high up on the food chain in regards to corporate success and say, hey, can I bend your ear for a minute? You know, I would love to ask you some questions, maybe personal ones about how you got to where you are.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it was a lot of luck. It was just so much luck. I was a sophomore in college. I had a friend who had an uncle that was a self-made millionaire. We were talking about this. I love to interview those people. So, like, you know, maybe you can interview my uncle. So I did. And I said, do you know any other people like you that are rich? And he said, all my friends are rich. And I'll never forget that. That was kind of a shocker, too. And I said, can I interview some of those people? And I think they saw me as someone not looking for to move up in society. I was a kid. I'm 19 years old, right? And I'm not looking to borrow money or anything like that. I have no money, of course. I'm a college student. And so I think they saw me as just a non-threat. And they thought they were helping a young kid out, which they were. And I just got in those circles and it just kept growing and growing to the point where by the 90s, I was interviewing multi-billionaires. And I mean, I interviewed over 300 billionaires over the years. And it continues today. And believe it or not, it just keeps going. And so I got really lucky because I got in their circle. And as long as I didn't violate the rules of the super rich circle, which I learned as I went along, because I did it a few times, I violated it a few times. And then I got slapped a little bit. Then I went back. They allowed me to stay. And I stay in those circles to this day. It's been a real gift, you know.
Can you share with us what some of those rules are? I'm curious. You know, are we talking about things that you felt were appropriate or quirky?
Yeah. So one of them is they don't like to talk about how much money they'll do it during an interview, but they don't like you to broadcast how much money they have. So I've done a lot of press, you know, I mean, I've done thousands of interviews, television, radio, you know, over the years, just because of the books and stuff. That's the main reason. And so a few times I mentioned some of a couple of the billionaires on it was actually in a newsletter, and it came out and it went right back to them. It was actually one of the, I won't name them of course now because I got slapped for that, but it was someone you would know, both of you would know, very famous billionaire. And he very nicely emailed me and said, please don't ever mention my name again or how much I'm worth or what I told you in a private interview at my home. Please don't do that anymore. He's a very nice guy. And that's one of the things they don't like to talk about, much money they have. They don't like you to tell, you know, the press about it. And I get calls still from the Wall Street Journal today on a regular basis saying, because they know how many of these people I know, and they say, what would Mr. Buffett say about this? What would Trump say about this? What would, you know, et cetera. And I always have to be very, very careful what I say, because they want it. Most of them are not flashy. They're not driving Ferraris. They're driving Ford F-150s that are 10 years old. You know, they're living in a regular house they built in 1965. A lot of them are like that I've experienced at least. And they don't want to be public. They don't want people to know how much money they have. And I was kind of bragging about it because I was impressed with my ability to get inside. And I learned very quickly to be quiet if I wanted to stay in their circles, because most of them are not flashy at all. In my experience.
So let's talk about those actual values or mindset lessons that perhaps you picked up from them. You mentioned a couple. You mentioned that they tend to not necessarily drive the fanciest car or live in the fanciest home or community. Was that in fact a thing that you observed regularly, and what do you make of it? And what other, you know, one or two maybe key characteristics did you encounter more often than not?
Yeah, like one of the things I thought was really interesting, you know, like in my 20s, for example, so I was making a little money, not a lot of money, just like a regular income. But I would invite them to go out. I'd say, hey, I'd like to take you out to a steakhouse somewhere. You know, they'd say, and I'd tell them a steakhouse in whatever city it was. And they'd say, oh, you know, this is a billionaire, a multimillionaire. They'd say, that's expensive. You're paying for it. I don't want you to pay for that. Let's go to, you know, Outback Steakhouse or something. We don't need to go to I need a $100, $200 steak. And I think, wow, that's really kind of cool. They're frugal. Most of them are very frugal. You know, and all you have to do is look. I mean, someone very famous we all know, like Warren Buffett, for example, Mr. Frugality himself, you know. So, I mean, a lot of them, I think, are like that. Like, again, just my personal limited experience. But that's one of the things I learned is frugality. They're not the flashy. The flashy ones usually are the ones that are leveraged to the hilt. They don't have any money. Typically, they have money, but they're in debt. They have more debt than they have money. Those are the ones I want to show you how rich they are. And the ones that are really rich, cash rich, they don't want you to know how much money they have at all. You know, most of the time I'd say, you know, when did you get rich? And they'd say, well, you know, what's rich? I mean, I don't really consider myself rich. Well, in Forbes, you know, Steve Forbes said you're worth $2.4 billion. They go, well, that's probably an over-exaggeration. I don't think we're worth anywhere near that much. I mean, I don't know where they're getting that. They go backwards. So I thought, isn't that interesting how humble they are and how they play everything down and the frugality of the way they live. I found to be fascinating.
Very cool. I bet just because they don't want people to always constantly evaluating them for the monetary amount that they have in their bank account, you know?
Probably right. Yeah.
Very interesting.
I mean, I think it's that. I also think it, you know, it's you put a target, it's like putting a bullseye on your back on some level. Too. And also, you know, there may be some considerations, you know, related to taxes and other things that, you know, they might be concerned about. I mean, you know, attention is not always the most positive thing. And in some cases I could see that being a motivator, but I do, from my own experience, also have seen that people that are particularly wealthy, and I, in more cases than not, it's those that have been generationally wealthy, tend to be both frugal and, unassuming. I've noticed that younger, maybe more, you know, nouveau riche or people that have acquired their wealth in their own lifetime, not always, but more often than those that didn't, tend to be a little bit flashier. Again, I haven't interviewed nearly as many or met nearly as many billionaires as Steve has, but that's been my observation from the handful that I've met.
I would agree with you 100%. Yeah. Yeah. Steve Forbes would be a good example of that, you know, from Forbes magazine. Of course, his fortune was, you know, made by his dad, Malcolm Forbes. But I've known Steve for, God, 25 years, probably. And he is one of the nicest people. We agree. We disagree on everything politically, I think, across the board, except maybe taxes. And we've had some good conversations over the years. But, like, he's one of the nicest guys I ever met. He's very frugal. He's a super nice, down-to-earth guy. There are a lot of them. Most of them are like that. To your point, though, Tal, some of the ones that are flashier are sort of the nouveau riche, the ones that live in Boca Raton, you know, that type of thing. Nothing against Boca Raton, but there's a lot of nouveau riche there. Where Palm Beach, for example, in Florida, is the old money, yeah, you know? Sure, maybe is. Outside of Trump, maybe.
Outside of, I was just going to say, you know, exactly. The entire time you were talking about, you know, the true billionaires being the ones that, you know, humbly push back on their value, and then there are others who take the opposite approach, but we'll leave it there. Let's talk about failure, because one of the things that you noted in our pre-interview, you spoke about the fact that you've had success. You founded four companies that achieved great success, that built multiple offices around the world, but at the same time you said you also failed, and you felt that failure in many ways hardened you and taught you, hardened you not in the sense of making you a less empathetic person, but hardened you in terms of preparing you for dealing with life and dealing with business failure from a different point of view. Can you share with the audience what you mean by that, and what is it that, you know, what is it about failing, or maybe even you can name one specific venture where the lessons learned were, you know, to use a commonly used phrase, were worth their weight in gold.
Yeah, well, you guys know how it is. It doesn't sound as good in the introduction when you say he's founded four multi-million dollar companies. Of course, he's failed at 40 companies. This doesn't sound as good. You say you leave the 40 failures out and keep the four in there. You look like a genius and everybody's happy. But, you know, the problem, of course, is that, I, you know, this is one of the things that these interviews, I mean, I'm just a small-time entrepreneur, you know, author, whatever, speaker, but, you know, but these whales I've interviewed over the years, I mean, I take their word far, you know, with far greater weight than my own, because obviously they're so much bigger players. But they said the same thing. I think we had the same experience that we all do as entrepreneurs, that you kind of fail your way to success. And once you realize that, I had so many interviews before I even started my first company that where they said, hey, you know, I'm a professional failure. You know, that's what they've said to me. And these guys are, you know, these guys are big players. And they said, yeah, I failed my way to success. I mean, but I have one big success. And a lot of them would say, you know, all you have to do is hit one home run, you know, and then everyone forgets you're all the strikeouts. I mean, Babe Ruth, you know, we all know the story, was the home run king, but also the strikeout king, as was Hank Aaron and a lot of other, you know, players like that. And so, but they don't talk about that. They just, everyone remembers the home run and says, well, what a genius. But I think you learn more, and not that this is anything that you guys don't know or anyone else doesn't know that's watching, but I think we all learn more from the failures. We don't enjoy them, but you do. I think you learn so much that you fail, at least in my experience, you fail. I failed so many times that I'm such a moron for so long that there's like one thing left that'll work that I haven't failed at. And I go, okay, pick that, because there's nothing else to pick, literally. So I go, okay, well, I guess I'll pick that one. And that one works because it's the only thing left to do that I haven't screwed up. You know, and then everyone goes, well, you know, you made X amount of dollars. You're a genius. I say, yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. Always have been. Just a pure genius. It's just ridiculous, you know.
There's some mad scientist to that. I kind of like it. Well, I mean, but all right. So you've done like all these ventures, right? Like obviously numerous ones, 4 to 40. You know, many of them didn't succeed. How do you manage to keep that determination going, that optimism going? Like, even, I know you're saying, oh, well, here's the last thing I haven't tried. But I mean, like, there has to be a little bit of internal fire to keep going, to keep pushing that boundary. How have you kept that going?
I guess, honestly, I mean, just at this point in my life, I just realized that I'm just completely unqualified to do anything where I could get a job or be employed by anyone. So I had no choice but to pick myself up and keep going, because no one in their right mind would hire me, including I would not hire me. You know, I'm unemployable. So you realize that, I mean, to some degree, I'm kidding around a little bit, but I mean, at some level, you know, you realize that, you know, I'm going to only be able to work for myself. So I better get off my ass and I better go back to work and try to figure something else out that I did, like, I won't screw up as bad, and see if I can do something that'll actually work and generate some success, because I got nowhere to go. Harvard's not knocking my door down. You know, Wall Street's not knocking my door down. Hollywood's not knocking. No one's calling me. So I better create something or starve. So I think it's out of desperation as much as anything else.
All right. So I'm going to try to reel us back, because let's put it this way. If someone who's sold 1.8 million books and is considered one of the top 1% speakers in the world has no value, I don't know what that says about us, PJ. I'm going to argue that you're humiliated. Well, one of two things. Either you are incredibly humble.
Or I'm moving to Tibet.
Admirable. Or you are just not very nice to yourself. I can't tell yet which it is. If it's the latter, you know, we've actually talked a lot about the need for kindness to oneself on the podcast. People tend to be way hard on themselves as entrepreneurs. So all kidding aside, are you hard on yourself more than perhaps you should be? Is it humility? Is it embarrassing to have been so successful? I don't know how many people on earth have sold nearly 2 million books. I'm going to say that number is going to be in the fraction of a fraction of a fraction of 1% of the humans on earth. So you've accomplished incredible things. Are you being self-effacing for the humor, or are you genuinely that self-effacing? And I know I'm asking you a question that you've probably never been asked before, but I'm genuinely curious.
You know, I think honestly, I mean, in all seriousness, probably 10 years ago when I was really in the height of everything and just going like a maniac, running all over the world and you know, crazy stuff. I mean, I'm almost 60 years old now. I'm looking at the world a little bit differently. And I look at, you know, whatever, you know, modest successes I've had compared to so many people that those so many incredible things. I try to look at it through, in all seriousness, through objective reality, which I talk about in mental toughness. And I realize honestly, with an all self-effacing, you know, of it, of the, that idea, you know, the humility piece aside, the mentorship I've been lucky enough to get because of these self-made millionaires, for one, and some of the people like Bill Gove, my mentor, and Larry, and some other people that have taken their time, that were so much more successful in these certain areas like writing and speaking and that kind of thing, corporate training, and took their time for no profit of their own and mentored me like other people mentor people. Without that mentorship, you know, I'd probably be teaching tennis lessons in Florida. I mean, honestly, I'm not trying to be overly, you know, humble or anything like that. I just think it's probably an objective reality that without mentorship, whatever, again, modest successes I've had probably would not have been there. So just the generosity of people to just ask a question, say, hey, can you guide me along the way? And they say yes for no profit of their own. It just shows the goodness of people. Without that, you know, I don't know where I'd be, but it wouldn't be very far.
Hey, look, I get the whole self-effacing thing. I get all the self-deprecation. I'm in it every day. Tal yells at me on several podcasts about how I need to be kinder to myself. And, you know, he's got a heart of gold, that one. So, Steve, I wanted to delve in a little bit more about this, which I think is lacking today in general, especially as I watch like the next generations coming up. It seems like we've kind of lost our way on critical thinking. And, you know, you have critical thinking and mental toughness that are skills you've identified for that are crucial for entrepreneurial success. Totally agree with that. What are the five, or what you feel are the top five principles of mental toughness?
Good question. I think I start off, you know, we always start off with companies. That's really where I spend most of my time doing turnarounds, sales teams turnarounds in large companies like J&J and Procter & Gamble and, you know, big companies like that. And so the first thing we start with is of getting the people into the objective reality, where they are, where their numbers really are. So if they're a great sales team, yet their performance is substandard, then we know there's a level of delusion there. And human beings are very prone to, all of us are prone to self-delusion. I mean, look at what's going on in the world now. People make these crazy claims, conspiracy theories, with absolutely no evidence to back them up.
Yeah.
Zero. And other people believe them to the millions of people. So, and it's not people are stupid, but emotion, because we're emotional creatures, we tend to fall for delusion. And so the first thing is get into objective reality in anywhere, in any area you are. Like when I retired from tennis, you know, people say, why'd you retire? Because I was going broke. You get tired of living in your car. you know, and the car's not that big. It's a small car. You know, it's got, you know, bald tires. And so I retired out of necessity. You know, you got
hard to get dates when you live in a car.
It's very hard to get dates. You know, you where are you going? The trunk? I mean, there's nowhere to go. So, you know, and there's
nothing. I hope not the trunk. That opened
not
up
the
a
trunk.
Whole new...
That was probably a bad choice. Yeah. Not the trunk. But, you know, I think that's the first thing. And that, so the first thing we look at is objective rail. Let's see where we really are. Let's trade wishful thinking for critical thinking and honesty and objective, you know, objectivity for delusion. And so that's the first thing we do. And that's a very tough pill to swallow, especially for salespeople in big companies. They don't typically like it. That's why we get lumped in with the turnarounds. But that's honestly a lot of where we had our success in corporate America and companies around the world as well, because we went in and we did the hard stuff that no one, we didn't do the motivational speaking. I don't get the standing ovations, you know, that my buddies like Les Brown and my old buddy Zig Ziglar and all these guys I worked with over so many years that used to get. You know, they get the standing ovations. I'm the guy that goes in on the back end and has to turn the numbers around or we get fired. And so I think that's number one. And critical thinking would be definitely a strong number two. And those as bookends are probably the biggest thing. So now you start giving people look at if you're going to make a statement, then you better back it up with evidence. Otherwise, it really has no credibility. And so once you start, living your life or your performance through that lens, everything changes. It's not exactly fun, but all of a sudden now you're building on a foundation of structure and solidity as opposed to these just delusion and wishful thinking. And so that's where we start the whole process.
So as I'm thinking that through, it ties into another point you had made in our pre-interview, which was it is oftentimes a lot harder to succeed than you think going in. There's more complexity. There's usually more cost. How do you factor in? I mean, so what aspects of mental toughness would you recommend an entrepreneur that's getting started look to build up? What are the, you know, you talked about being able to focus on reality, and I get that. But what are some aspects of that, you know, people should be mindful of, given the fact that it is normally harder and more expensive to get going than you usually anticipate?
Well, yeah, you guys know how it is. As an entrepreneur, you write the business plan, 75 pages, maybe 100 pages, and everything in linear fashion, as it should, goes right according to the business plan. And then you all end up with more money, know what to do with, and everyone retires and drinks out of a coconut or a palm tree for the rest of their life.
Wow, so you too. Version. That's awesome.
Right? That's what happens, right? I just came from the palm tree. It's right over here.
Oh, wonderful.
But, you know, it doesn't work like that, of course. And you write the business plan and then you get into the business and you say, what the hell is this? You know, you're 6 months into the business going, we got to write the whole business plan, rewrite the whole thing. Yeah. Who wrote this thing? Oh, I did. That's right. You know, you realize that you're probably underfunded before you even write a word. After, you know, you do it four or five times, you build four or five companies and you think, okay, well, before you put a word on the business plan, you go, I'm underfunded. I don't care how much money we've got. We're underfunded. It's going to take four times as long as we actually have in the business plan. And how do we know? We just know. That's probably what's going to happen. And you start to, I think, you know, to your point, you look at the expectations and you say, how badly do I really want to do this? Because if I really want to do it, this is going to be a war, most likely. And then once in a while, you know, maybe twice in my 40-year career, you get lucky on something. You get, you know, you just guess the right way. The market turns. Something shifts in the economy. And you get lucky. You're right place, right time. Money flows like water. And everyone thinks you're a genius. But it doesn't usually happen that way. You know, if you're around long enough, you get lucky. You know, like they say, the broken clock is right, you know.
Twice a day.
So it's that kind of thing where I think, but normally, you know, it's going to be just a battle. It's going to be an absolute war. And so you got to go in. I think if you're, I don't want to say smart, but I think if you're pragmatic, you're going to go in saying, you know, we're probably underestimating the effort, the time, the money, the team, everything. It's the tools, everything it's going to do, it's going to take to build this empire or this business or company or whatever it might be. And I think when you go in with that as a seasoned entrepreneur, now when things start to go crazy, you go, well, this is the way it is. This is what building a company is about, you know.
That's awesome.
I want to stay there for a minute. A lot of what you said, I think, is just fact. It is almost always the case that you plan for, even if you think you're planning for contingencies, you oftentimes can't think quite what the contingencies might be, and you end up running into scenarios you hadn't considered. So that's, I believe, a fact. I do think, however, that that some of what you said there is more negative than it needs to be about the journey, right? So, I mean, if you say, well, we're going to, you know, whatever it is that we plan, we're going to take four times as long, we're going to spend twice as much money, we're going to have half as much success. I with that premise, you have to be insane to get into business. So is it your belief that entrepreneurs are insane, almost definitionally, or is there some, again, and I'm not trying to be a party pooper, but I am trying to bring the conversation someplace where it will hopefully be useful to people in the audience who are either beginning businesses or thinking about it. What's the is there a happy medium between what you described and the experience of most entrepreneurs in your view, or is this just your view of the world, which is you're entitled to, of course?
Yeah, I think most entrepreneurs are insane. I and I'm not kidding. I mean, not really insane, not clinically insane, but I think at some level you have to be
not
a little
clinically
crazy.
Insane. I love it. You're the first guest so far that has said on our show that he thinks they're insane, but not clinically so. Go carry on.
Not clinically so, but somewhat insane. I mean, what kind of a nut job has to build something from scratch? I mean, go to school, pay attention, get good grades, get a good job, work 9 to 5 and have a good life and go off, you know? But no, we can't do that. We got to buck the rules. We got to make the rules. We have to control everything. You know, we're nut jobs at some level, I think. But, you know, we enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. And the reason I purposely, you know, take the sort of, as you said, negative view of it, as although I think there's a lot of realism in it, depending. I mean, every deal is different, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think that if you set your expectations seriously, if you set your expectations where it's you're probably underestimating everything in a business plan, then when things tend to go off the rails, which a lot of times they do because you don't have as much information usually as you think you do, then you're not so surprised and you're not so taken aback at the challenges. And so, but if you're expecting things to be tougher, then it's not really a big shock. And I think the truth is they usually are. Although again, once in a while, yes, you get lucky, everything goes the right way, market changes, all these different things, that there's a lot of luck involved in success. And I think anyone that denies that is either delusional or arrogant, probably at some level, because sometimes you're just at the right place at the right time. You really, and a lot of times I think that's true. And then we get on shows like this or whatever, or, you know, different things, and we say, well, you know, I just, I'm that good, or I'm that smart, or whatever. And, you know, I mean, there's obviously talent involved in it, but like anything else, but luck plays a pretty big role. I really believe that.
Yeah. I think that entrepreneurs put themselves out there to be able to capitalize on that luck, right? Like if they don't take the, if they don't have the initiative to really get something started, well, then that luck will probably just go to someone else, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. But I do agree. I think, you know, this has actually been a consistent theme, and we've had other people on the show who have also interviewed hugely successful people. And that does seem consistent to me. I think ultimately you may be very talented, you may have had great ideas and not achieved anywhere near the success of others, not because they are geniuses, masters of the universe, but simply because they had better luck. And that better luck could take on different forms. Maybe they ran into someone, or they knew someone, or the timing was just right. And that, there's no denying that. And I think that accepting that is not the same as saying that it's entirely luck. It's not the same as saying, well, then what's the point of planning or thinking it through or trying to prepare? It's none of that. But it is to say that ultimately you could do all those things and do them exceptionally well, prepare, plan, think through, war game, strategize, and merely for not having enough luck, fall short. So I think that's what Steve is saying here. I don't think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I don't think what you're saying is it's entirely luck and nothing else. I think your point of view is consistent with what we've heard from most of the guests we've had on the show in our two seasons, which is, heck, if you don't think luck has something to do with it, you're just lying to yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So Steve, you had mentioned in our pre-interview about a quote for, which had to do with crying and complaining quote unquote, crying and complaining through challenges. We all have, of course, moments of doubt and frustration. Can you share how you personally balance these very human reactions with the mental toughness that you teach?
Yes, I can, BJ, and thank you for asking. I cried and complained all the way through COVID. I got it twice, by the way. Yeah. I had it pretty bad the first time.
Yep.
That was a different thing. So I cried and complained when I had it two times as well. But yeah, we took a bath during the 2 years of COVID because most of our companies now are the companies we run now are events companies. And so there were no events, which means we lost millions of dollars. And I'm kind of laughing about it now, but mostly crying, a lot of tears, a lot of boo-hoo, like tears falling on the ground, you know, curled up like in the fetal position, not mentally tough at all. I didn't talk about that at the Today Show or Good Morning America. I was very mentally tough during those 4-minute interviews. But other than that, I was not very mentally tough at all because it just took a path. Just, you know, but I, you know, we're talking about entrepreneurism too, and it's part of it. You know, luckily we saved enough and we were conservative enough and frugal enough, I guess, to and lucky enough as well to be able to sustain it financially. But, you know, we still took a bath. But luckily we survived and we came out of it, you know. And but yeah, a lot of crying, complaining, even realizing no one cares, no one's listening. But just feels good that the fetal position is actually a fairly comfortable position when you're just bleeding cash. Yeah. So I recommend that, actually.
You know, funny enough, and I think that the fetal position is underappreciated. And I myself have found myself in it. And some people maybe find themselves on their knees and asking for help from a higher power, which is, I think, another version of that. I think actually recognizing that you are powerless over something or that something is just so overwhelming that your capacity as a human being, forget professional, entrepreneur, just as a human, to deal with it in any kind of a constructive way has reached its limits. And the best you can do at that moment is just hang on. And I think that that's okay. I would say, however, that I don't think that that's a strategy, or it's certainly not a winning one. In my experience, you need to give a certain amount of time to your frustrations, but then you really do need to bottle them up and move on from them. How does that play into your thesis around mental toughness?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, and I think humor is a great, we talk about mental toughness all the time. Humor is a great way to offset, you know, tremendous pressure and just like going back to COVID, just using that as an example where everything shut down. And, you know, a lot of us just felt, I know I just felt powerless, and I hadn't felt that feeling in a long time. I mean, I just forgot how tough of a feeling that is to just feel powerless to say I laid off people, like a lot of companies did. I laid off, you know, lots and lots of people. Every day I was laying off people. It seemed like all over the world. And, you know, it's a tough thing. It's one thing when you're looking at your own bank account and saying, okay, well, we'll figure it out. But, you know, these people rely, these are week to week, month to month people who are, this is a big deal, you know, and you're having to lay them off, and that's hard. But outside of that, I think when you look at your own situation, not other people's, but your own, using humor is kind of, I mean, I was talking to my wife, you know, who runs our oversees all our companies. And, you know, I told her, I said, hey, look, we, you know, 40 years ago, we started with nothing. We may end up with nothing, but, you know, we laughed and had a good time back then, and we'll laugh and have a good time then. If that happens again, living out of our car, and we'll have to build it up back over all over again. We did it once. I suppose we could do it again. But, you know, we had fun even when we had nothing. So maybe we go back to that, and we laughed all the way through COVID. Even though we cried through COVID, we laughed through it. But I think humor is one of the things that is underappreciated or underused, maybe I should say, by a lot of us, because we get so wrapped up in the tension and the pressure of it that we forget about humor. But I think that helps a lot as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's awesome. I want to delve into something that obviously you're doing now, which is you are the El Presidente of the International Personal Development Association. And you have a stated goal of reducing human suffering. So can you tell us more about this organization, the plans on how it's going to impact our collective consciousness and promote the philosophy of helping others? I'm very intrigued by this.
Yeah, one of the things I thought was so cool, you guys, that interviewing these people over, now this next year, 2024, it'll be 40 years of interviewing all these rich people, self-made millionaires. And one of the coolest things they ever said to me going back to the 1980s was You spend your first half, this as some version of this, they would say, you spend your first half of your life as an entrepreneur accumulating your wealth, and the second half giving it all away. And I thought, that is so cool. And of course, Mr. Buffett and Mr. Gates and some of these guys with the giving pledge, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people on that list as well. And that, like, these, I think that's so cool, because it's one thing just to go out and, you know, and spend money, and that's all fun, and we all like to do that, and it's fun to do that stuff. But there's nothing like giving it away to people who really need it. You know, like, do I need a new Ferrari? Do you need a new mansion? Do you need a new fill in the blank, whatever it is? But people need housing. People need transportation. People need clothing. Like, the world is suffering. I mean, we're all the luckiest people in the world, probably, you know, right? Among the luckiest people in the world. I mean, we have.
But Steve, do you really find, I mean, I agree with you in theory that there's nothing. That I certainly think there are opportunities to give money away. And there are certain people, I would say, Melinda Gates, Bill Gates on the Bill Gates and Melinda Gates Foundation certainly would be one example of that. But at the same time, there are also a lot of people giving $100 million to schools with $5 billion endowments to build a business center named after them. So to me, I'm seeing a whole lot of, you know, self-aggrandizing giving by the very wealthy. And perhaps I'm just not hearing about the other giving. They're very worthwhile causes. At the same time, some of those causes, those worthwhile causes, require so much resources that really, unfortunately, as much as you might want to help, there are reasons that you want high-functioning governments who are capable of solving these issues. But the bottom line is, I tend to not see, at least in my experience, the kind of giving you're talking about from the very wealthy. I tend to see the self-aggrandizing giving. Tell me why I'm wrong, or what is it that you're seeing differently than I am?
Yeah, I could promise you. Well, I can't promise you this. I guess I could promise you, in terms of my experience with the ones I know, that they're far more quiet philanthropists you've never heard of that are really, really wealthy, that give their money away, that don't tell anyone, that don't want any credit, that don't want to be in the newspaper, than there are the self-aggrandizing ones. That's just my experience. I'm just one, you know, one study, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. But that I find that they're, I know, you know, lots of these people, and they, and those are the, there's more of them. But the self-aggrandizing thing, like they accuse Oprah of and some other people of, I say, give them all the credit in the world. People, this is not about buying a bigger house or a fancier car. This is about people surviving. This is about clean drinking water. You know, this is serious stuff. So let them put their name on any building they want or any car they want to, or, you know, whatever. But going back to your question, I had modest success. I don't have, I'm a small business person. I don't have that kind of cash to fund big projects like that. So with the personal development, the International Personal Development Association, our idea is to band people together that are fans and friends of personal development around the world, of which there are, they say, upwards of 500 million people. I don't know that that's true, but that's what sometimes people say in the industry. I know there's a lot of them. I don't know how many, actually, because they've never been banded together formally, to create a consciousness where people are doing personal, we call them personal development acts of kindness, where they're helping an old lady walk across the street, or they're carrying someone's groceries to the car. Some little thing, because most of us don't have big money to give away, or even small money to give away, or any money to give away. But we can, you know, help somebody chase their dog down who got away at the park, you know, or do something very small like that, or smile, give a smile, you know, to a stranger, or tell the person bagging your groceries that they're doing a great job. Something so little like that that we can all afford to do, I think could literally change the collective consciousness of the world. It's a big goal, but it's something the masses, the rest of us, not the super rich, but the rest of us can participate in. And that's the purpose. That's the main purpose of this association that we're putting together.
How do you raise that to the consciousness of more people? I mean, what you're talking about sounds like paying it forward on some level. It also sounds like the whole concept of, you know, you throw a stone and the ripple could be felt across the seas. I get it. I love it. How do you get more people to see that as an alternative to sitting on your hands, even if you're not in a position to, you know, give out significant amounts of money or time? for that matter?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Tal. So our idea is we're calling it personal development 2.0. So 1.0 basically for 100 years, and you guys know this and what people viewing it know this, but basically it's been about personal development. I develop myself. Hopefully I become financially independent and happier, and I'm a better marriage partner, and I'm a better parent and whatever else, you know. And that's been great. And that obviously has worked for a lot of us. And I love personal development. I mean, all these books I've got in this house, we just got, you know, I don't even know how many thousands of books. They're all personal development books. They've been great. And it's been life-changing for me and a lot of other people. But 2.0 to me is I'm going to feel better about myself if I do something for someone else. It also helps the person in need, but it helps me as well. Because when I do something very small, I saw a lady struggling. She had a little kid, and she had a bottle of a case of water on her shoulder, and she's carrying it to the car the other day, and it was raining. And I looked at it, and I thought, I need to help her. But it was dark, and I thought she might think I'm being creepy or threatening or something. So I said, is there any way I can just carry that to your car? Because you look like you're... She said, oh, please, please. And I carried it to her car, and this is a tiny little thing. It took 30 seconds, and it wasn't difficult for me to do. And I went back in my car, and suddenly I felt better about myself than I did 30 seconds ago. Oh. And I thought, that's personal development 2.0. I'm helping myself by helping someone else. And if we could spread that collective consciousness, I think it would reduce depression. It would reduce suicide rates. And it could literally change the way people think when they're interacting with other people, especially people in some kind of need.
I have a short story to tell about that. I wholeheartedly agree, by the way. I was in New Orleans this weekend. PJ knows that. We spoke about it earlier in the week. And there was a man who had a poster board that said, I will tell you six dirty jokes for $5. And you know what? He, by the look of him, I would say he was probably homeless, at least the way he was dressed and the amount of stuff he had with him. The group I was with, we decided, frankly, let's do it. Let's give him $5. Here are his six jokes. They were hilarious. I can't repeat them. It's way inappropriate, but they were very funny. He was very funny. And I thought to myself, you know, here's a guy, probably the alternative for him is to hold out a cup and hope people put dollars in it. But he actually instead decided he would add value in some way. I'm sure most people walked by him and didn't think to ask him to tell him a joke. But I love the fact that he, in his own way, try to add value to the situation, and that for us, it gave us an opportunity to do something good, frankly, without embarrassing someone. There's something to be said for we paid him to tell us jokes rather than giving him $5 and walking away.
I love that. Yeah, that's fantastic.
That is very cool.
And I'll tell you the jokes after we're done recording because they
were. I want to hear those jokes sure. I'm willing to give you $250 to hear the jokes. 50%. That's not bad.
What a deal.
PTL chip in a buck, deal. I'm sure.
Yeah, why not? Why not? I just want to eventually one day get to the point where I am self-aggrandizing all over the place. That would be amazing. But on a lighter note, Mr. 1.8 million books sold. You had mentioned that your favorite book is also your worst seller. So, and I believe it was called, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Sex, Politics, and Religion, How Delusional Thinking is Destroying America, a staple for every Thanksgiving dinner table out there.
Any conversation. I mean, you basically covered the bases there. Yeah, right? Sex, politics, and religion. It's exactly what you should be talking about.
That's not what I heard when I was growing up, but who knows, right? I was living in a cloister, apparently. How did you reconcile your personal fondness for this, right? You had like inside you're excited about this, about the book, but you know, it didn't receive the accolades that other works had, or at least popularity other works had. And like, how did you reconcile that? And what do you think those lessons can teach us about the difference between what is true success and what is personal satisfaction?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought this up because I'm just dying to sell more of these books. So I'll put my pitch up here. Please buy this book. But one person bought this book was my mother, and a month later she returned it for a full refund.
Nice.
So that's not good. That's not a good sign. That's not a good book.
Try the veal, tippy waitresses. I got it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know. So no. So the story of it is, I promised myself when I got to my net worth goal. This going way back, because I learned it from a self-made millionaire. Says, get to your net worth goal and then start figuring out how to give it all back. And figure it out. So it was about 2010, 2011, I guess it was. And I said, okay, when I get to that goal, I'm going to write a book and tell people what I really think about these really sex, politics, religion, and related 50 related topics of those three subsets of those topics. And so whether I sold any books or not, and I don't know how many we sold, but it's certainly not very many, relatively speaking. But I just wanted to have my say on these topics because I think they're things that we should be talking about. You know, we should be talking about, you know, all these topics, you know, marriage and sex and money, and no one teaches kids how money works and things like that.
That's true.
And I just wanted to do it for me more than anything else. And it turned out great because I'm the only one that read the damn thing. So yeah, I guess.
Well, since you're here and we are a top 1% podcast, you probably have more people listening than read the book. What is the thesis? What was your thesis? What is the delusional thinking that you felt was destroying America?
Well, so much of it. I mean, so many things. I'm just like, okay, I'll take a softer one, like how money works. You know, people don't teach kids. We don't teach kids in school in America, in the richest country in the world, how money works. We don't teach them. Most people, out of 100 people on the street, they can't explain to you what compound interest really is. They really don't understand debt. They don't really understand, you know, that most people are living on from paycheck to paycheck, and they're making a decent amount of money, but they still don't have any money because. Because so many of these things, these basic things that you can literally teach an eighth grader, we don't teach. And so I took a shot at that. I took a shot at, you know, marriage, which is obviously, you know, a lot of times people say, well, it's the foundation of the world, or it's foundation, let's say, of the country. And it's a colossal failure. I've been married for 40 years, but the institute, I've been lucky, but the institution is a colossal failure. But we don't talk about that. You know, yeah. We don't teach kids about that. And we don't. So just little topics like the people you just should not talk about. Sex is another one. You know, where you guys learned about sex. I learned it from, you know, the Playboy magazines under my dad's, you know, mattress that I had to get. And you get, you know, you used to collect those. And those.
Did you see PJ's mom? Did you know that PJ's mom was in Playboy? That is a true story.
Seriously?
Yep.
Yes.
I may have that issue. I mean, I'm going to check for that. Which issue was it?
It was August 63.
Okay. I think. Oh, Marianne?
All right. Hold on. Just
that
remember,
was fantastic.
We're talking,
just so you know.
We're talking about my mom.
That's true. All right. That's
let's,
true.
Let's
Merry Christmas, PJ.
Simmer down now.
It's Chicago. You're tough, man. You can take
that's
it.
True,
you're
that's
Chicago.
True. Also, she had all of her.
Where's your
on.
Mental toughness, PJ? After an hour with Steve, you should be as thick as an elephant.
That's right. That's right.
I'm still trying to figure out how to spell self-aggrandizing. So don't worry about that. I'm stuck.
That's
on
fine.
That.
I've been struggling with entrepreneurialism all of this podcast.
That is a big one.
I don't know what's going on with that. Considering what our podcast is about, I think I should be able to at least say it.
I know.
I don't know about do it, but say it.
Can you buy a vowel? I guess you can.
Yes, I can.
That's amazing. That's.
I have a question for you, Steve. On the first topic, the topic of teaching people money. How much of that do you think is about the fact that, let's face it, high finance is essentially the Wizard of Oz? I mean, people don't quite understand that fancy terms like, say, quantitative easing are nothing more than we're just going to print money. So, I mean, and I am not a doomsdayer. I am not someone that believes in conspiracy theories. I happen to think, however, that there's some sort of self-preservation. Societal self-preservation in ensuring that the extent to which the average person understands finance is not quite on the level that would maybe help them see just how much of that is smoke and mirrors. What do you think about that?
Yeah, information and financial information is asymmetric. There's no question. I mean, but I'm not talking about, you know, teaching kids how to trade derivatives on Wall Street. I'm talking about things like, okay, for example, 401k. Okay, that's sort of the new pension, right? Companies don't want to pay a pension. Government doesn't want to pay a pension because they're, you know, all the pensions are underfunded anyway, of course. state, federal, all of them. And so they don't want to do it anymore. Companies don't want it anymore. So they put it on the average person who knows nothing about finance whatsoever and says, oh, I'll put it in a 401k. So the guy ends up saying, well, I'm going to retire. I got $400,000 in my 401k. Well, what he doesn't realize, he's not dumb. He just has just hasn't been educated on it. That's all. He doesn't realize that $400,000, he's going to be taxed on when he takes it out. He might have 200 if he's lucky. He might have 150. And all of a sudden he goes from thinking he's got 400 to having half because he's going to get hammered on the taxes. Whereas the wealthy, of course, don't put their money in instruments like 401ks, which are not really good products. Okay. This is just basic stuff. This is not complicated or anything like that. You can teach someone this in 20 minutes. So it's anyone, even a high school kid. And to say, hey, you put your money, you pay the taxes up front on the seed. You don't pay it on the harvest when it grows to a monstrous amount. That's what the wealthy do. They hardly pay taxes at all because they know enough about the tax code to know a legal way to keep their money from being taxed to high heaven where they don't have any, where the masses are getting hammered. That's why Buffett pays less in taxes than a secretary, percentage-wise, of course, not money-wise, but percentage-wise. And so I'm just talking about basics, Tal, nothing too crazy or because you're right. You're absolutely right. It is the wizard. I mean, I know a lot of people on Wall Street and it is the wizard and I'm not one of them. I don't have that Wizard of Oz thing. I'm just a normal person with average intelligence. But some of those people, some of those quants it is very asymmetrical. They have the information we don't. But I'm just talking about the basic level. I'm selfless plug here, but we wrote this book. I'm a co-author myself, Tom Matthews. Wrote this book, How Money Works, and it's just a basic book. We've passed out probably 400,000, 500,000 copies of this book in the last few years to high schools and colleges just to get people, kids, the basics of money. And we funded it just to try to get people the basics of it because the government's not teaching them. Schools aren't teaching them.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think it's a good point. And I think even as I think about your point about marriage, and I have had unsuccessful ones myself, and I'm not currently married, but I think the institution makes a lot of sense.
We Tinder, Tal. Go on Tinder. That's the key. That's the key to success, right?
Beautiful,
there.
Lovely girlfriend.
Just swipe. I've never been out, but I've heard you swipe. It's not that hard. Pretty easy to learn.
I can attest to you swipe.
I'm good. Thank you. But I will say this. I'll be turning 50 very soon. In fact, by the time this episode plays, I will have turned 50. And I know things now that I never knew. And had I known them 20 or 30 years ago, I would have been likely more successful, perhaps, I'm not sure that I would have had the mental bandwidth to process it the same way that I can process it now. But I guess I would say, we've talked a lot about a book that didn't sell very well compared to the other books. But interestingly, I think these are the topics, whether it's sex or politics or religion or marriage, the most people care most deeply about. And for one reason or another, act of omission, act of commission, they are not taught well. We're not taught how to treat people very well. Our parents attempt to do that if we're fortunate, if you happen to be in a household where your parents teach you manners, but even the concept of manners is oftentimes in some households, frankly, treated as a way to keep people down, to keep your children down, or limit people's ability to speak up for themselves, as opposed to what it really should be, which is you treat everyone at eye level with respect. But that also means you expect respect back. So I think it's interesting, and maybe we should have you back to have a deeper conversation on this topic. That isn't our agenda for today. But I'm curious, why this book didn't do well. Obviously, your name sells books, and so presumably people, for some reason or another, didn't think this was a topic you had a whole lot to say about, which is interesting in and of itself. I don't know. I don't know what your where that fits in your narrative for why the book didn't do well.
Yeah, I have a theory, Tal. I'm glad you asked. Nobody cares what I think about sex, politics, or religion. Nobody cares. Not even my mother. My own mother doesn't care. So that's not good. That's not very impressive. And probably wondering.
Well, you know what? If we're to draw a lesson here for our audience members who are business people and aspiring business people, you know what? If you're going to go out there and take a position on something or start something or try to speak on something, make sure it's something that people think you actually have expertise on. Look what happened to Steve. He is proof positive that if you talk about something you know nothing about, or that people assume you know nothing about, that you're not likely to have success no matter who you are. So, you know,
and you end up in the fetal
maybe
position.
Maybe that's the lesson.
Corner, like I have
fetal position. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm glad we're back at fetal position.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, I think that should be the takeaway from this episode for our audience. You should spend more time in the fetal position, ideally crying hysterically while doing it. I think that, that for sure is the message we want to convey. What do you think, PJ?
That's a modicum of positivity that we're throwing out there.
Modicum. All right. There's another word that we
have. That's a good word, PJ.
I forgot all about my quest.
I found that on my own
volition.
Throw
in some words.
How about that? That's dandy.
That is dandy. That is dandy.
Wow. Well, what a swell way to end our show.
It was amazing. Thank you so much, Steve. Personally, I'm going to order 4 of those money books because I got kids who...
It's buy one, get 10 free.
You get a case of these for free. Oh,
perfect.
That's right. Don't send them.
With them. I don't care. I got to get rid of these books.
So the EPA's at my door. What are you guys burning? That's fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your insight and your humor. And I thought this was great. Would love to have you back on. Absolutely.
I appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me on. I'm a big fan of the podcast, and that's an honor to be on with you guys. Lots of fun.
And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard, want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook. Visit us on YouTube, and please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.